Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Monday, the 5th of May. It is all things political, two huge primaries tomorrow. And of course, we'll start our conversation with Julie Mason with those primaries and, of course, go beyond that as well. Julie Mason is our guest, White House correspondent for the Houston Chronicle Washington Bureau. She has written recently about the North Carolina-Indiana primaries and the gas tax and many, many other issues. She's been on this campaign for a long, long time. We'll be welcoming phone calls. She asks in one of her recent pieces from last week, anyone care to predict Tuesday finishes, which may be a good question to ask you this hour. 800-486-8655 is our number, 800-486-8655. If you're joining us in Milwaukee, it is 414-227-2050, 414-227-2050 for you to join our conversation. Or you can send an email, and that is talk@WPR.org, talk@WPR.org. Hello, Julie.
Kathleen, it's great to be back on your show.
Yeah, great to have you on. Well, just about a month left.
Not too much time. It feels like this campaign has been going on for 10 years, doesn't it?
Oh, it does for you, I'm sure. And it's starting to feel that way for us as well. You asked in one of your blogs recently, does anyone care to predict tomorrow's finishes? Would you like to do that?
Sure, I'll predict tomorrow's finish. Yesterday I was on the phone with an Obama block walker who'd just gotten back from Indiana, and he told me that he thinks Obama is toast there.
Really?
Yeah, he just couldn't. He was in lots of different neighborhoods, lots of different parts of the state, and he really couldn't find much support for Obama at all. I think she's going to take that state, not by much. But I think he's going to win in North Carolina, which means, if I'm right, they're going to split the states, and we're going to be right back where we were, where we are today. No decision.
Yeah. What's happened to his campaign? Is it the right thing? He just, you know, he's kind of off his game here.
He is. For the past couple months, he's really lost his luster. He's lost his footing. And I think it's a few things. I think it is the right thing. Is a big deal. I also think that the shine has come off his candidacy a little bit. You know, he was so iconic going in, and he had so many people fired up. But now we're learning more about him, and we're seeing him in, a more realistic light. And naturally, his numbers were going to come down because he just started off so high out of Iowa. And so I think the luster has come off it a little bit, and I think that's what we're seeing.
Mm-hmm. You write about the fact that he said when you're running for president, you make certain assumptions that people after 15 months really know who you are, he said in Indianapolis. And then you realize maybe there are still a whole bunch of folks who don't know who you are despite the fact that you're on TV every day. How can that be?
Well, people are busy. This is what we know, that people are very busy. They don't watch the news. You know, I have cable on my desk. I have a TV, and it's on all day. But that's not everyone. That's an exception. And I think people develop surface impressions because that's all the time they have. Or they may take some time on the internet to read up a few things and develop some impressions. But they're not living and dying by this campaign like the candidates do or the press does. And I think he's had a real hard time getting past those surface impressions and really telling people who he is.
Mm-hmm. And she has this image now as a very tough fighter, mm-hmm. signing boxing gloves, et cetera, on the campaign trail. People kind of like that, huh?
They do. They do. She's extraordinary because she has these high negatives. You know, so many people have a real strong, visceral dislike for her. But at the same time, she's such a tough campaigner, you can't count her out. And that's the thing. If it was anybody else performing as she has, trailing in delegates, trailing in the popular vote, they wouldn't even be treated like a real contender. You know, they'd be, just being pushed right onto the race. But it's a real testament to her fortitude that she's still in this race and still has created the perception that it's a real contest.
Let's talk about the gas tax. Everybody's talking about this now. Survey taken very recently showing Americans divided over the merits of the gas tax suspension, which has also been of course, backed by Senator John McCain. Obama is saying it's political gimmickry. Uh-huh. What are you getting from this? Are people taken to this gas tax, or do they think it is just a gimmick?
Well, it's interesting. There's a new poll out today showing that 70% of Americans think the gas tax is a gimmick. They think it's a politician just pandering. But at the same time, they like it. They want it.
Yeah.
And that's what Hillary Clinton has been able to do, is to say, look, I'm giving you some relief. And And there's I have yet to hear a single economist say that it's a good idea or that it will work. But she's getting a lot of traction because here she is trying to solve a problem. And I think a lot of voters give her credit for that because everyone's hurting from gas prices. I mean, that is something that affects everyone. And here's Obama saying it's a bad idea, and his, you know, alternative is a middle-class tax break, which is a good idea, but it's apples and oranges. Mm-hmm. You know, so people say, here's Hillary Clinton. She's addressing gas prices, and he's not. And he's still talking about Reverend Wright. So she's had a great couple of weeks. He's had a terrible couple of weeks.
Right. How does he get off Reverend Wright, if ever?
He can't. And this is where his inexperience as a politician really shows. Mm. You remember when the Bosnia thing came up for Hillary Clinton a few weeks ago? That was a three-day story, and then she pivoted so deftly. She went right into the economy and changed the subject. He's been unable to do that. And that's a real political skill, is to, with real, real decision, just change the subject. And he's been unable to do that.
He said this interesting thing on Meet the Press yesterday, I think, when he was talking about this niceness factor, you know, that he didn't take on right earlier because there's a part of him that doesn't want to criticize people, which probably doesn't work very well in a presidential campaign.
No, this has been a problem for Obama, and it's been so interesting to watch, is that he wants to have the election be a high-minded debate of the issues, and he doesn't want a negative campaign. He wants to do it a new way. But you can't remake our political system. It is a brawl. It's a street-level brawl, and he doesn't want to engage in that brawl. And this is an instance where you see him being tripped up by that, by his unwillingness to play it the old way. And we may all abhor the old way and think it's terrible and really want a debate of the issues, but that's just not realistic. It denies something fundamental about our system.
Yeah. And he could have pounded on her on the Bosnia story.
Couldn't he? Really could have. But he didn't have to. You know, it hurt her without him doing that. So I think he did play that one right, because she between her and Bill Clinton, you know, they just made a mess out of that situation. And so he didn't really have to get involved. But at the same time, he really could have hit her hard on it.
Yeah.
He chose not to.
How does she pull off a win?
A win for the nomination?
Yeah.
Well, the only card she has left to play is convincing the superdelegates, those who are uncommitted or undeclared, or those who have declared for Obama and they can still switch sides, to convince them that she is the best candidate for November. And that is a tough road. She cannot make up the difference in delegates. She can't make up the difference in popular vote. It's the only card she has left.
So she tomorrow then, am I right, would have to win Indiana and North Carolina?
Yeah, you know, North Carolina is a tough one for her because he has an advantage going in. But she's made this argument that she can win the big states. She can put together the win that could beat McCain in November. But if she loses North Carolina, well, that kind of blows that argument out of the water, because North Carolina is the state that she would need in November. So, and Indiana really isn't. Indiana's a red state. You know, Democrats aren't counting on Indiana in November. So she really needs to do extremely well to make that argument.
Mm-hmm. And his poll numbers, he used to be way ahead in North Carolina. That's no longer the case.
Right. She narrowed his lead down to single digits. I think she's, you know, the polls I've seen show her about 7 points behind. But he came in at about 17 points ahead. So she's been able to cut into that lead pretty well. Like I said, she's had a couple of few good weeks. I think it's really helped her there.
Mm-hmm. And was why the change in North Carolina? What's narrowed the gap?
I think he's just had a tough time of it. I don't think it's anything in particular. The economy, like everywhere, is a big issue. There's a lot of black voters in North Carolina. I think that's going to buoy him. But I don't think it's any one particular issue in that state that's changed it. I think it's just changing perceptions about her.
Mm-hmm. Our phone number, if you'd like to talk with Julie for our All Things Political segment the day before the North Carolina and Indiana primaries, is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. If you're joining us in Milwaukee, it is 414-227-2050, 414-227-2050. And just a programming note for you, tomorrow we will be having special coverage on the Ideas Network from 8 until 10, 2 hours of election coverage and analysis from NPR. After 8, Michelle Norris and Melissa Block will host special coverage of the primaries. And then after 9, this will be interesting, Neil Conan will host a nationwide call-in on the day's events. So that's tomorrow night from 8 until 10 here on the Ideas Network. And then, of course, we'll be covering the results from Indiana and North Carolina on Wednesday, and we'll be covering covering it on this show. Joy will cover it on her show, and Ben will cover it on his show as well. So all of that is coming up. For those of you who have followed politics with us for a long, long time, let's go to phone calls for Julie. She is the White House correspondent for the Houston Chronicle Washington Bureau. And we start our calls, Julie, with Mike from Racine. Hi, Mike.
Hi.
Hi.
A little frustrated. I'm sure your guests, not to take it out on your guests, but routinely these analysts and people that come on talk shows like this, they keep talking about there's no chance on a popular vote. But when you include Florida and Michigan, and I think that in the final decision, final analysis, that the Democrats are going to be smart to include the Florida and Michigan results, because quite frankly, those are going to be two states which are going to be way, way important in the general election. And if the superdelegates don't take the voting patterns that happened in Michigan and Florida, forget about how it happened, but if they don't take that, keep that in mind, they're very likely going to make a bad decision. And this is coming from someone who's has not made up their mind and am typically a Republican voter. But it just makes no sense. Mm-hmm. Two big states like that are completely out of the thing because of DNC infighting. If there's any reason why people don't like the Democratic Party, you're looking at it right there.
What are they going to do with those states, Julie?
Well, I think what they're going to end up doing is seating the delegates and splitting them if we're still at two candidates come the conventions. But, you know, the caller, Mike, makes an important point about the popular vote. But the problem is that the nominee isn't decided based on popular vote. It's based on delegates. So popular vote is beside the point. Michigan and Florida are still really unresolved issues. Of course, they were disqualified, both of them, because they moved up their primaries in violation of party rules. And neither state was able to organize a do-over, which would have been great at the time for Hillary Clinton, but they really couldn't manage that. So now I think the popular vote issue is dead for both those states, but the caller's absolutely right that they're very key states for the Democratic Party, and the party is going to have to come up with a way to mollify those voters. I think it's going to be to seat the delegates at the convention.
Mm-hmm. Thanks, Mike, for your call.
Thanks, Mike.
Zach is from Green Bay. Hi, Zach.
Good morning. I want to take issue with some of the basic underlying assumptions that your guest is making. Number one, that we've recently found out a lot about Obama during the past several weeks. What exactly is that? That he doesn't wear a flag pin? That through 60 seconds of sound bites, we can define Reverend Wright, and by guilt by association, we can define Obama? And this elitist nonsense, putting it on somebody who was raised by a single mother and who not too long ago paid off his college loans. What we are observing are contrived issues created by an irresponsible corporate media designed to destroy his candidacy. And on top of that, pushing this idea that this is still a close race, Hillary has to win about 70% of the remaining votes to even have a chance to take this nomination. And I think this is a classic example of our corporate media doing a huge disservice to the country and not doing its job to report issues instead of creating nonsensical issues.
How do you think the press should have handled, because it is a story, Zach, Wright's comments were deeply offensive to a lot of people in this country. How should the press have covered that?
I would say how they should cover it is having more than 60 seconds worth of excerpts from two speeches. I saw Bill Moyer's interview of Reverend Wright, half-hour interview, 2 weeks ago. It shows 5 minutes of that speech, which gives it some context. But context and depth are two things that today's corporate media has no interest in.
Julie.
Well, the issue of the flag pin keeps coming up, and I know that people have taken strong issue with the media about that. The thing to remember is wherever he goes, the issue is brought up, and not by reporters. It's brought up by voters, by people who are concerned. There's a real whisper campaign going on against Barack Obama, and the whispers are that he is unpatriotic, that he's a Muslim. He keeps having to address this, and it's not coming from the media. I do think that the media could do a much better job of in-depth reporting on these issues. I really do. The problem is, you know, most people are getting their news off the internet now, and newspapers are hurting. I think there are still papers who do an excellent job. The New York Times and the Wall Street Journal have great in-depth coverage, both in the paper and on the web, of the campaigns. The Washington Post is also doing a fantastic job. So it's really left to the giant newspapers to give the kind of in-depth reporting, because you're not going to get it on cable. You're not even going to get it on the nightly news. But those are the places to look for the kind of serious reporting that voters seem to really want.
Mm-hmm. You do have to wonder, too, after all of the controversy, even if it were media created or not, what the heck Jeremiah Wright is doing here. Is he jealous of Obama, or is he must know he's hurting his campaign?
Yes, he does. I think he seems to me to be a real sort of narcissist.
Right.
To really care more about correcting his own image mm-hmm. than helping out Obama's campaign. And that was certainly something Obama expressed after Reverend Wright's speech at the National Press Club, which was devastating for Obama. It was terrible for his campaign. And I think the Obama campaign would really like Reverend Wright to stop making speeches and stop making appearances. But Reverend Wright, he has his own agenda, and that is to correct the record about himself.
Yeah. More phone calls in a moment. Julie Mason is our guest, White House correspondent for the Houston Chronicle, Washington Bureau. We're centering our all things political discussion on the big primaries tomorrow in North Carolina and in Indiana, and welcoming your phone calls. Our lines have been crowded. There is one line open right now at 800-486-8655, or in Milwaukee, 414-227-2050, or you can use that email address, which is talk@WPR.org. talk@WPR.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. The second hour of our program this Monday, we talk about the controversy surrounding bottled water. Julie Mason, our guest now. Mark from Whitewater is our next caller. Hey, Mike. Hey, Mark.
Hi.
Hi.
Well, I guess I'd like to talk about the difference in the context between Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama. So Hillary was on record as voting in favor of the Iraq War. She has essentially made these bald-faced lies about the Bosnian issue. And in both cases, she's not being held responsible for them. In contrast, Senator Obama has been pilloried for remarks that he did not make. Reverend Wright made those. And furthermore, if you listen to the tapes from that Wright speech that were presented on Point the other day, and you hear what Reverend Wright was saying, he actually, while perhaps poorly making it, makes a good point. He was talking about the injustices in America, and he was talking about them in the context of some person saying, God bless America. And he's saying, well, if you're going to do these things and have the sanctimonious issue of saying, God bless America, then unfortunately he used God damn America, which is offensive to many people. But I think it was an effective way of putting that in context. If you're going to put people in slavery and you want to say, God bless America, well, then perhaps God damn America isn't an inappropriate thing to say. And so I think that Senator Obama is being held responsible for remarks that he did not make, whereas Senator Clinton she voted for the Iraq War, and just keeps trying to talk her way around it. And then this Bosnian thing, they keep repeating it and repeating it, even after CBS News shows her waltzing off the plane with Sheryl Crow and her daughter. And I'll take my comments off the air.
All right. Thanks, Mark.
Well, I think that Hillary Clinton is being held accountable for her vote on Iraq and the misstatements on Bosnia. I mean, she's trailing Obama. I mean, I think both those things really hurt her. They undercut the argument that many of her critics have, or the feeling that many of her critics have, that she'll do anything to win, or that she's all about politics, or that she's dishonest. You know, these are things that show up in polls where you ask people how they feel about the candidates. These are things that come up over and over. And I think that the Iraq vote really hurt her. And Bosnia, you know, less, but I think it sort of shored up some bad feelings that people have about her. On the right thing, you know, I think there's a big debate within the Democratic Party among voters, as we hear on this show. You know, some people see it one way, people see it another way. The question is, if Obama is the nominee, which I believe he will be, how are Republicans going to use the right thing in the fall, and how's he going to deal with it? That's a big question.
Yeah. What about her comments concerning obliterating Iran?
That's tough. I mean, that's really, really tough. She sounds very, very hawkish. I'm not sure that sits well with Democratic primary voters. I mean, I think people want a robust policy on Iran, but Americans are so exhausted by this war.
Right.
And I'm not sure that being very tough on Iran and threatening to obliterate them helps her politically.
Mm-hmm. Let's go next to John from Milwaukee. Hi, John.
Hi. Before, one of your callers asked about how the media should have covered Reverend Wright. And one of the things I just saw recently was on April 3rd in the Chicago Tribune, Lawrence Korb, who was Assistant Secretary of Defense in the Reagan administration, had written an op-ed on Reverend Wright. And in it, the way he covered it is he talked about the history of Reverend Wright, and he talked about how in 1961 he gave up his student deferment, left college in Virginia, and volunteered for the Marines. And then it talked about after his two-year enlistment was up in the Marines, he volunteered again to become a Navy corpsman and ended up providing medical convalescence help to LBJ after he underwent his 1966 surgery. And it talked about how the White House awarded him three letters of commendation. And then it compared it to some of the other leaders that talk about patriotism and compared it to Dick Cheney and how Dick Cheney received five deferments while he was actually born the same year that Reverend Wright was. And so when you talk about patriotism, you have to put it into perspective and actually provide not only a sound clip of what he said, but you have to provide a background of the actions that the man has provided in his life and compare it to other leaders. And I think that the problem is that it's much easier for the soundbite to get out, whereas this op-ed in the Chicago Tribune, I doubt many people have seen it. I emailed it out and sent it to a number of my friends and just said, here's an op-ed on the right stuff. And I think the media needs to do that. They need to confront these sound bites and actually provide background information to educate people so they know what to be thinking about when they look at them.
Julie.
Yeah, well, I agree 100%, and it's true in this soundbite culture. It's so bombastic on cable. They have 24 hours to fill, and they give you little snippets of news, and what the reader did was perfect. He went to the Chicago Tribune, which is an excellent newspaper, who have done great, heroic coverage of Obama, and looked for more information, and I think that's really a good thing to do. If you hear something on the news and you want to know more, go to your local paper or go to a big online newspaper and find out more.
Yeah. It is something how they pick these snippets of things and you go on and on and on and on with them. It is tedious after a while.
It is. It is. But the assumption is they assume that most people tune in for about 20 minutes, half an hour, and then they go on with their day. But if you sit there and watch it all day, it gets incredibly repetitive.
Yeah. Thanks, John, very much for the call. And
yes, thank
people
you.
Can be directed to that op-ed on April 3rd if they'd like to look it up. Let's go next to Margie from Milwaukee. Hi, Margie.
Hi. I've been listening, and I just agree so much with the last caller and another caller earlier that said, you know, things have gotten muddied right now. I think Hillary Clinton is hitting Obama below the knees and then just running away with it. And Obama has character and integrity. And I do think that he's kind of wavering, like, okay, what do I do now? Because he doesn't fight the same way. And just because Hillary found an Achilles heel doesn't mean that she doesn't have an Achilles leg. I mean, I am so upset that all we have come to do is know a little bit more about Obama, and now people know he's not a god, okay? He's a person, and maybe he has friends that don't always agree with him, but he's not hiding it. He's dealing with it up front, and And yeah, Clinton's just a master of making comments go away. They did that during the whole Clinton time in the White House. And she can make Bill shut up and sit down. And Obama can't do that to Wright. But if you had Bill out there talking as much as Wright does, don't you think Hillary would be in trouble? And why don't they take all of the people that, all of the really evangelical people that are on, that have encouraged on McCain's side and put the things that they say? Oh, my God. And I'm Christian, I'm Catholic, I'm religious, and they are just talking absolutely nonsense.
There is a double standard in that regard. I agree with you. The comments about what happened with Katrina coming down because there was a gay rights parade scheduled for that day. I mean, some of that is just as outrageous, Julie.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, agreed. And it's true, McCain has not had the same kind of scrutiny that Hillary and Obama have, for sure. But, I mean, his day's coming. You know, he's the nominee, right. And when it's down to two, it's going to get... it's going to get tough for McCain. You know, you see his numbers going up because no one's really talking about him. He's just kind of cruising along.
Yeah, right. Thanks very much, Margie, for the call. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 227-2050 in Milwaukee. All Things Political on Mondays at 9. And Julie Mason, White House correspondent for the Houston Chronicle Washington Bureau, is our guest. You can also send an email if you can't get through on a phone. And that's talk@WPR.org. We have a couple lines open for you right now. Kaz from Milwaukee, hi.
Hi, yeah, I just wanted to express kind of my general satisfaction with you know, the seriousness that everyone takes this kind of nomination process. I mean, I really appreciated the caller that talked about, you know, the corporate media and how Obama's gain is so significant, and that's a fact. But, you know, ultimately both candidates, all three candidates, represent mainstream candidates funded by large corporations, not the average person. And the large corporations that fund everything set the agenda, decade after decade, and that will never change, provided that we don't have public campaign financing of elections. You know, we seem to think that Obama is a savior, you know, or at least, you know, kind of the progressive movement seems to look at Obama as a savior. But at the end of the day, you know, he's towing the line in a most expensive presidential election in the history of the world, you know, and I think that we need to remember that. No candidate will save us. They all represent the same melting pot. You know, no candidate also takes a serious stance on the war, for example, or health care. You know, and I just think it's important to remember that. Thank you.
Julie.
Interesting. Is that cynical optimism or optimistic cynicism? It's true. It's absolutely true what he says. It is so expensive to run for president, especially the TV ads and the travel. They eat up so much money, and corporations are important. You can't say they can't accept direct contributions from a corporation, but members of a corporation, individuals, can contribute, and they do. I think Obama's come pretty close. He's got a lot of small contributors who, in fact, one of my readers told me recently that he felt like his parents had Obama on layaway. You know, and every month they put a little bit more down on Obama. You know, they're paying you $20 a month to his campaign. He's got a lot of small contributors. Mm-hmm. So I think that's the closest thing to sort of a, you know, a populist formula that we see this year.
Yeah. Let's go to Al from St. Germain. Hi, Al.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call. I've got a question for Julie. How did Hillary Clinton get this far in the race? Because maybe the whole country, the people, the moral decay of the people are voting for her. I mean, the crooked dealings before they were even in the White House, the mysterious death of Vince Foster and several other people in their administration and who they dealt with. The $100,000 in the commodities market, somebody went to jail for that, Martha Stewart. And are we going to have to face bimbo eruptions again? Because now Bill Clinton isn't going to have all that much to do in the White House. And I think his eyes are going to be roving. And I'm almost ashamed to say I'm Catholic because I understand that in Pennsylvania, it was the the Catholics and older women who you would think would be would know better put her voted for her. And so I guess with, you know, I mean, Obama has got his detractions too, but I just cannot see living through four more years of Clinton-type shenanigans.
Julie.
Well, I think what the caller is saying represents what a lot of people feel about the Clintons, a sort of puzzlement that with all this, you know, she's gotten as far as she had, and it's several reasons. One, she just has put together a terrific organization, a really strong organization built on her long-standing ties within the Democratic Party that she and Bill Clinton worked on for decades and decades, building up this sort of political machine. It's really helped her. Also, you know, it is puzzling about the, you know, I think a lot of voters wonder, what is it with these older women who support Hillary Clinton? Shouldn't they know better? Well, I think their overriding issue is that she is a woman, a strong woman with a viable chance to be president, and that's more important to them than her husband's failings. And that's what I hear over and over from women who are such staunch supporters of Hillary Clinton. They are diehards. When you go to her events, it's full of women, and it's full of slightly older women 50s and 60s, who just love her to pieces. Hmm. And when we talk about Catholic voters, I think we're talking about largely white middle-class voters. And that's a very strong constituency for her as well, because her economic plans have been a lot stronger than Obama's.
Yeah. How is she able to maneuver herself to be in so good with blue-collar workers? It is true that Obama has the resume that would resonate more with those. But Hillary is really... gotten that voter. How did that happen?
Well, it's a few things. One, he's not great on economic issues. He's not as sure-footed. He has some good plans, but, you know, he talks in just broad generalities, mm-hmm. sort of sweeping, epic tones, and she talks very specifically and very concisely about what she's going to do. And I think that really resonates with people who want some help or want to know how someone's going to lead, not in broad themes and sort of unifying arguments, but here are my specific plans. And that's really helped her with those voters.
Why has John Edwards remained silent, Julie?
John Edwards, that's a conundrum because, you know, he could play such an important role
right.
in this. I think it's a lot of reasons. John Edwards is disappointed in being knocked out of the race. He doesn't like either of them very much. Naturally, you'd think he would tend towards Obama because they speak in similar ways about the poor and the disenfranchised and about these themes of unifying America. But at the same time, when Obama went to meet with him, apparently one-on-one, Edwards was not impressed. He thought Obama was a bit arrogant, a bit dismissive, and sort of, you know, get on board with me.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas Hillary Clinton really went and courted him and said, look, John, you know, here's what I want to do. Here's how I'm like you. And so then he was just stuck. And now he's just staying out of it for reasons of his own. But he really could make a difference in this race.
Mm-hmm. Al, thanks for the call. John from Rice Lake is next. Hi, John.
Hey, good morning.
Good morning.
It sounds like we got a potluck politics discussion going.
Right.
I've actually been intrigued with Barack Obama. A lot of it's been his ability to speak very articulately, but I really tried hard to listen to what he's saying. I read a speech that he delivered in Philadelphia a while back a few times, and you know, actually indulged in the Reverend Wright videos online, and went through Huffington Post to read a lot about this because of just kind of going through the computer through those channels, which I found out is very liberal and democratic. But, you know, I wanted to listen to it all myself. And what I sense is Barack's a very articulate, well-composed gentleman in a lot of ways. And I think he's drawn a lot of people in. What I see is a lot of people, a lot of minorities supporting him in this race, which I don't feel is really the majority of American. I do think that Hillary might have a better chance of winning if going up against McCain, although, you know, there's a lot of pro-Obama supporters, and I feel like they've really bought into his sound bites of change and not a lot of substance, and I think there's a real desire for change. But my real concern as someone who tried to follow this is, you know, what are they really getting? And trying to, you know, listen to him and, you know, listen, reading his speech a few times over, you know, that the Huffington Post commentary sounded like they were trying to make him sound like Martin Luther King. I really struggled with the lack of people really paying attention to what he said there. He victimized black people in that speech. He threw America to the side, saying, you know, that slavery was America's original sin, when it's historically inaccurate. When you look at slavery and how it was practiced throughout the world, and black people were selling black people, which was very unfortunate. But you know what? I'm not a part of that. You're not a part of that. And we shouldn't be held, you know, and his own people shouldn't be held as victims. Reverend Wright, he was trying to bail him out, and he shouldn't have, which he obviously realizes this is a real issue with his campaign when he has Wright speaking the way he does. When I watched Reverend Wright's sermons, I was like, this guy should move back to Africa. He is not happy being here, and I've traveled the world, and I'm like, you know what, our lower-class people have such a better life than the lower-class people of so many other nations, largely because of people paying taxes, and a lot of them. And
all right, let's get a response.
Which we should respect greatly. And so I really struggle with what he's saying and people not really listening and digging deeper into it.
Julie.
It's interesting. I think the Democratic Party started out this year really very, very happy with itself and almost self-congratulatory, saying we have this terrific black candidate, we have a woman, and doesn't this say great things about America?
Right.
But I think as the race has progressed, we have learned some things about America that maybe we're not comfortable with. That black voters vote for a black candidate and white voters vote for a white candidate, and it's not as great as I think many white voters thought it was. And I think that black voters are aware that it's a problem, and that white voters are coming to this awareness.
Yeah.
And it's not as great and shiny and bright as many Democrats started the year out thinking. And I think the caller raises some really interesting points about that.
I did think, though, his Philadelphia speech was extraordinary. I thought it was a beautiful speech. I really did.
It was an extraordinary political moment. It really was.
Yeah. Thanks very much, John, for the call. We pause for a moment and return. Julie Mason is our guest, White House correspondent for the Houston Chronicle, Washington Bureau. Monday is All Things Political. And we're concentrating, of course, on the big primaries tomorrow, North Carolina and in Indiana. And welcome to your calls. One line is open, 800-486-8655, 227-2050 in Milwaukee. Email talk@WPR.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Second hour of our program today, bottled water is the topic. And the question is whether or not this mass consumption of bottled water has been creating serious problems for the planet. Julie Mason, our guest now. Julie is White House correspondent for the Houston Chronicle, Washington Bureau, and we go to Dave from Ellison Bay. Hi, Dave.
Good morning. Thanks for taking my call. As usual, it's an interesting program. And like I told your screener, what I'd like to do is comment on the poll regarding the gas tax, which is sort of where you started, and suggest that I think what that reveals is sort of the what I consider one of the roots of the problem with respect to what these campaigns usually reveal. Number one is that I think most people have a sense that government, especially federal government, is out of control, or as Ronald Reagan, I think, said, is the problem and not the solution to the problem. So, you know, the poll says, well, everybody says the gas tax is a gimmick, it's a political gimmick, etc., but we like it because it puts a little money in our pocket.
Mm-hmm.
Exactly.
You know, so, you know, what that says is, you know, people, it says two things. People see the government as, you know, as a problem, or as a, you know, it's a gimmick. It's somehow a problem that needs to be fixed, but rather than really fix it, we'll take the handout that's offered, and that's reflected, I think, also in the, you know, our choices for president or whatever the major office is. And that's the sense is that, well, like with Obama now, you know, he's young, he's black. Well, you know, the older whites have screwed it up so bad, he couldn't do any worse. And he talks nicely, and he does. He's articulate. And the Philadelphia speech, like several people have said, I thought it was a great commentary on the racial problems that, you know, or where we're at now racially. But anyway, the big problem, I think, is not with so much with the candidates, because I think they're a reflection of us, regardless of what people have to say about the corporate control of the process, which I think is a reality. But we tolerate it. I mean, the citizens, you know, we the people of this country tolerate the system that we have. We don't really understand how much we're dependent on it or how we make ourselves dependent on it. So we're not really, either we're ignorant about how to fix it or, you know, whether it should be fixed or anything. You know, but again, I think the biggest problem is the fact that so many people are dependent on the state, either by fact or by default. And, you know, that, which is a huge problem economically, where people are paying more and more taxes for, you know, for what. But anyway, I mean, it is, you know, unfortunately, you know, I remember, and I don't know if this is true or not, supposedly Thomas Jefferson, who some consider the father of American democracy, allegedly said that there should be a revolution every 20 years. you know, and here's a guy
though
that lived through one where they did risk their lives, fortunes, and sacred honor to try to establish some better form of representative, you know, government where people consented to things that made sense rather than just sort of rubber stamp this huge, huge political machine that more and more does not make sense and cost so much that we just can't afford it.
Mm. Julie.
I know. I have a cascade of thoughts.
Yeah.
First, I would say that people do vote their self-interest. It's true, and that's what we see in that poll about the gas tax. Like, yeah, it's a gimmick. Yeah, you're pandering, but hey, if it's $50, I'll take it. We also see that in President Bush's tax cuts. The same thing. People really thought it was just gimmickry and would probably hurt the economy, but, you know, they'll take the money. And it's funny, if you watched the recent John Adams series on HBO, of course, it was such a reminder of the high aspirations that this country was founded on, and it was a good and timely reminder, but then with this terrible economy and the mortgage crisis, yeah, people are going to vote their pocketbooks. They ought to. It can't always be about principles. It just isn't, although we'd like it to be.
Yeah, but it has to go way beyond that little minuscule $30 or $38 you're going to get in your pocket. It seems to me as though none of the candidates have described to our satisfaction this broad vision that we need to bring family-paying jobs back to the Midwest, back to the South, keep them from going overseas, figuring out new ways to make money, keeping people from having to work two jobs or college kids from having to pay back student loans for years and years. I don't see that broad vision, which I think we're really crying out for right now. And it goes way beyond a little tiny gas tax.
Right, you're absolutely right.
Thanks, Dave, very much for your call. Let's go to Jim from Oshkosh next. Hi, Jim.
Yes, good morning. I'm curious to know your guest's opinion about the Republican crossover vote into the Democratic primaries for the purpose of trying to get Hillary Clinton as the nominee, because the Republicans feel that she has so much more baggage that it would be easier to run against her. And the reason I say that is that Howard Dean was on the national news over the weekend on Sunday on Meet the Press, and he was touting the fact that so many Republicans have switched to the Democratic Party and that the Democratic Party's voter base has increased significantly. So that tends to lead me to believe that there's a lot of shenanigans, if you want to call it, of Republicans crossing over, and this is giving Hillary Clinton a lift when in a normal election with Democrats she might not have such a lift. And I'll listen to the answer off the air.
All right. Thank you, Jim.
Well, that is a terrific question. There's been a lot of Republican troublemaking in the Democratic primaries this year in the states where they're allowed to do that. But, you know, I'm not sure it's really benefiting Hillary Clinton that much. We saw in the Texas primary a lot of Republicans crossed over and voted in the Democratic primary. But it was about half voting for Hillary so that she would be the nominee, and then half voting for Obama just for an opportunity to vote against Hillary Clinton. So it ended up being a bit of a wash in Texas. And as for, you know, the Democratic Party signing up all these Republicans, well, I tend to think most of them will go back to their own party in the fall, even if they're not fully content with John McCain. I think he's the lesser of two evils if you're looking at either Hillary or Obama on the ballot.
Thanks for the call. Jerry from Amherst. Hi.
Hi. I guess I'm just wanting to shift gears a little bit to the Middle East.
Sure.
And I'm feeling like it's a little bit deja vu all over again with the saber rattling towards Iran. It seems like in the run-up to Iraq, every time whatever justification for military action was, you know, was kind of debunked, they would just shift the rhetoric and have a new justification, and I'm kind of feeling like that's happening again in Iran. You know, the National Intelligence Estimate kind of took the wind out of their sails for a while, and then they just said, well, we don't believe it. And, you know, it seems like, you know, then there was that boat that allegedly, you know, harassed a naval ship, and that didn't gain any traction. So they just kind of move on with a new story, and I kind of think they're using the Prime Minister of Iraq's talks with Iran to again find a new bit of traction towards action in Iran that's separated from the U.S. government by using a different government as a puppet. But you know, I don't want to sound like a conspiracy theorist or anything. I'm just curious as to whether there's any anyone who's kind of holding a mirror up, or at least got their ears on in the Washington media, thinking, "Ah, this sounds familiar." Well, just 5 years passed, or whatever.
Julie.
Yes. Oh, yeah. Yeah, sure. That's something that we pay very close attention to at the White House. Certainly, interestingly, this actually won't surprise the caller, but it's been Vice President Cheney who's been the loudest saber rattler on Iran. Bush has backed off from that. He sees that as a non-starter, and he really would like, in terms of the Middle East, he really would like to see the Israelis and the Palestinians work something out before he leaves office. And so to the extent that he's really focused on the region, he's focused on that. I wouldn't say it's 100%. At the same time, yeah, you're right. The NIE didn't go their way on Iran, and Bush reportedly has said that he didn't believe it, that he was discounting that. It's a bit of hearsay, but it seems plausible. It really hasn't come up much lately, a little bit here and there, but not consistently, not to the point where the media is really focused on it or really covering it day to day generally.
Mm-hmm. Thanks for your call. Bill is next. Hi, Bill.
Hi. I want to tell you, this is one of the most entertaining shows and good shows that I've heard in a long time, and I'm totally in agreement with your grander vision scheme. I mean, that's what we out here in the farmlands and the older folks are looking for, is the kinds of things that you were talking about. The last part of my comment is that I'm absolutely amazed that the younger women in this country haven't joined their older mothers and aunts and supported Hillary Clinton from the women's movement things. You know, I've coached women's sports for 35 years, and I'm just absolutely amazed that these young women have been flim-flawed by this good talker. Thank you.
All right, thanks for the call. Why haven't they? Why are they going for Obama?
Well, that's something I was really interested in. It seems like women in their early 40s are supporting Hillary Clinton out of sort of a sense of guilt and obligation because their mothers marched, or maybe marched for feminism, and so they feel like it's sort of a fulfillment of their mother's wishes. And, of course, I'm speaking very generally. But younger women in their 20s and early 30s generally express a feeling that it is one of the great benefits of feminism that they can vote for whoever they want. Mm-hmm. And they don't have to vote for a woman just because she's a woman, that women have progressed beyond a point of that kind of identity politics, and that's a good result of feminism, which their older counterparts would certainly disagree with. So that's an interesting generational debate,
right,
among women that I see.
So what are you going to be looking for tomorrow, Julie?
Oh, man. I am really interested in whether Obama can put together a win with, you know, more white voters and more older voters, maybe some rural voters, see if he can bring them over to his side. I see this race pull polarizing so much. And it'll be interesting to see if he makes any inroads with any of these traditional Clinton constituencies.
Yeah. Will you be in Washington? Or are you?
I will. I will. And then in a couple of days, I'm off to Texas for Jenna Bush's wedding.
So, oh, my gosh.
Quick turnaround for me.
When's that wedding?
Saturday.
Oh, it's this Saturday?
Mm-hmm, at the ranch, yep.
Hey, you bring a present? You have to bring a present?
I was not invited. The media are explicitly not invited.
Well, you got quite a week.
Yeah.
Thanks, Julie.
Thank you, Kathleen. Yeah. It's been terrific.
Yeah, it's always a pleasure to have Julie on. Julie Mason, she is the White House correspondent for the Houston Chronicle, Washington Bureau. And just a reminder to you that tomorrow night here on the Ideas Network from 8 until 10, 2 hours of election coverage and analysis from NPR. After 8, Michelle Norris and Melissa Block will host special coverage of the primaries. And then after 9, Neil Conan will host a nationwide call-in on the day's events. So I'm sure it's going to be very well done, as always, and extremely interesting. That's tomorrow night from 8 until 10 on the Ideas Network. And be sure and join me Wednesday at 9 as we cover the results from Indiana and North Carolina as well. I'm sure that Joy and Ben will also be covering the results on their shows. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing the hour. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for on-air production here in our Milwaukee studios. And thanks, everybody, for your most interesting calls this morning. News is coming up from National Public Radio momentarily, and we'll return with more Monday conversation. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.